Okay, before the exam, we looked at Lavoisier and what he did. Now we're into the next generation, Berzelius, Gay-Lussac, Davy, and then Liebig and Wöhler. We started Berzelius last time, talked particularly about his developing the notation we still use for composition. But of course, knowing what the composition was required analysis. So he was important in analysis, which relates then to atomic weights. And we'll also talk today about electrolysis and how it led to the theory of dualism. So you'll see the range of things that Berzelius contributed to. So atomic weights and equivalents. These were Dalton's atomic weights. As of the last time I looked, these were the atomic weights for those same elements, right? So what's wrong with Dalton's atomic weights? Obviously, he didn't have high precision stuff, so you don't expect it to be right to four decimal places. But what's fundamentally wrong with his? Yeah, Sonny?
Two of the elements had the same atomic weight.
Can't hear, Ralph. Well, why not? But as you compare his with ours, what's the most dramatic difference? Dennis, what do you say? So what's the big difference? Madeline, what do you say? Are his right, Dalton's? So what, was he just fantastically off base? Can you see what his problem was? What was the assumption he made that was wrong? His first assumption, yeah. No, that's not it. That's true, but that's not the problem with these numbers. Yeah. He thought what?
He didn't know there were neutrons.
Well, no, he didn't know neutrons. Neutrons weren't known for another 100 years, but that's not the main problem. What was his first assumption about formulas of compounds, binary compounds, things with two elements in it? Like water. Sharif?
He thought they were one to one, atom to atom,
right? If you had two. So methane would be CH, water would be OH, and so on. But now we know that atoms have different valences, right? So that carbon has two valences. So that nitrogen has three valences, carbon has two valences, oxygen has four valences. Now, what am I doing wrong here? I'm not doing it right. So nitrogen and phosphorus are both trivalent. So they'll each combine with three hydrogens, right? So hydrogen should be, the weight of hydrogen that combines with nitrogen should be three atoms of hydrogen, not one. Right, so you had to say that nitrogen was a third of 14, right, or five in Dalton's scheme, where you assumed they were one to one. So it was because of the valence being wrong. And if you correct for valence, then you find that Dalton's weights for the equivalence for the atoms are off by roughly 10%. Right, so that's about how accurate he was in measuring things. So about a 10% error. But the big problem was not this 5 or 10% error. The big factor was a factor of 2 or a factor of 3, depending on how many atoms of one thing another thing combined with. Okay? So when people wrote formulae for silicon chloride, Thomas Thomson in Scotland wrote SiCl, Leopold Gmelin in Germany wrote SiCl2, Berzelius in Sweden wrote SiCl3, and Odling in England wrote SiCl4, because they had different ideas of what the combining ratios were of the atoms. Right? So how could you possibly know what the combining ratios are? Well, Gay-Lussac in Paris had an idea in 1809. In 1804, he had ascended in a balloon to an altitude record almost as high as the top of Everest, which stood for 50 years. Okay, he and Biot, whom we'll mention later on. Okay. And why did he do it? Not to establish a record, but to find out whether the atmosphere had the same composition at high altitude and low. Remember Dalton being interested in that. Okay, another thing he did was find that if you use sodium chlorate as an oxidizing agent, that was able to oxidize sugar completely. Remember Lavoisier had the trouble with chard and so on. What did Lavoisier do? Do you remember, in order to analyze sugar, when he couldn't burn it without charring? Merov? He fermented it to get out the CO2. So that was able to clean up Lavoisier's results in some cases. But the other thing he found was that water, if you convert it to hydrogen and oxygen gas, you know how you do that? How? Pardon me? Electrolysis, right? Or if you combine hydrogen and oxygen gas, right, in a given ratio to give only water and nothing else, then he found that it was 1.9989 volumes, not weight. Remember, Lavoisier had focused attention on weight, but Gay-Lussac noticed if you used volume instead of weight, then you got simple integral ratios, volumes of gas at standard temperature and pressure, of course. So that's very good. It's within, a part in 1,000 of being correct. Okay, and ammonia gave just about 3 volumes of hydrogen per volume of nitrogen. So this, on the basis of volumes, whose name do you associate this with? Do you know? It's Avogadro, who did similar things at the same time. But I think Gay-Lussac was a little cleaner. So focusing on the volume of gases rather than the weight of material helped clean up these ratios. But it wouldn't be widely recognized that that really held until 60 years later. Right? That was a real revolution in understanding chemistry 60 years later, and we'll talk about that when we get there. Okay, so it was an alternative to Dalton's law of greatest simplicity, that you have one-to-one ratio atom by atom. So Dalton had the idea of atoms, but he couldn't get the ratios right. Okay, now there were other techniques that related to this, like Mitscherlich, an Austrian, used this fancy device to measure the angles accurately of crystals. So you mount a crystal and reflect light off it into this telescope, light from a point source into this telescope, focused light. Okay, and then on this scale you rotate it until another face comes into position to do the same rotation, right? So you know how many degrees you had to rotate to go from one face to the next face to make them in the same orientation, and it could be measured with this device quite accurately. So he wrote this paper on relating crystal shape to the chemical proportions, that is to the formula, to how many atoms, what the weight ratios of individual atoms are. And he did it not for every atom, of course, but for arsenic and phosphorus. And the way he did it was this. So arsenic and arsenates and phosphates. So he had crystals of arsenates, ammonium, hydrogen, arsenate, and ammonium, hydrogen, phosphate. And he found that they had the same shape. Right? Now, how accurate, how precisely did they have the same shape? Well, he measured the angles between, using that device, between these various faces. And he found, for example, that the angle between two M prime faces on the arsenate was 85 degrees 54 minutes, and on the phosphate was 84 degrees 30 minutes. Right? And then he did the same with other pairs. And if we go down the whole list, we find that that first one was, in fact, the greatest error, that most of them are within a few tenths of a degree. Right? So these crystals were exactly the same in their shape, as well as he could measure them, or almost exactly. So they were isomorphous. They had the same shape. Now, you don't know how atoms are arranged in these crystals, but whatever it is, to give crystals that are precisely the same shape, it must be that whatever phosphorus does in one, arsenic does the same thing in the other, is arranged the same way. If they were completely different different molecular shapes, as we would say, then they would be completely different physical shapes as well, macroscopic shapes. So this showed then, this helped answer this question. So is water HO, as Dalton said, or is it H2O, as Gay-Lussac said, by looking at the gas volumes? Well, isomorphism provided definitive weight ratios for some atom pairs. For example, the arsenic atoms must play exactly the same role, as we said in arsenates, that phosphorus atoms play in phosphates. So if you have 100 grams of a combination of nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen, which appear in these salts, and they combine with 30.64 grams of phosphorus in the phosphate, or 78.11 grams of arsenic in the arsenate, then those weights of phosphorus and arsenic must contain the same number of atoms. Does everybody see the logic of that? It must be that you can exactly replace atom for atom an arsenic with a phosphorus and get the same, exactly the same structure. Getting the same structure means you can replace them one for one in whatever the structure is. Okay? So, and you know the weights of the two, so you know the weight ratios of the atoms. So the arsenic atom is 2.55 times as heavy as phosphorus. It can't be half that or twice that or any other integral number of that. It's exactly that. Okay? So isomorphism helped in some cases, but of course you couldn't do it for all elements. So Berzelius in 1831 had this table of atomic and molecular weights. And you can see there are two, if we zoom in on it a little bit, there are two different columns where he gives atomic weights of these things. And it can be based either on oxygen being 100 or hydrogen being 1. Right? So if you take hydrogen to be 1, then notice he has two kinds of hydrogen here, hydrogen and hydrogen with a bar. Can you guess what the bar means? Pardon me?
Yes.
It means a doubled atom, right? What we would call a molecule, two hydrogens. So if two hydrogens is one, that's what he's taking here to be one, then one hydrogen is five, is half, I mean, 0.5. Okay, so the bars denote doubled atoms. And here, if we scale it to compare his things by just scaling to get the modern scale with oxygen being about 16, then you can see that Berzelius was off by 1% or less in his atomic weights. What was Dalton off by? 10%, right? So here's a factor of 10 improvement by 1831. Okay, now, and remember, he determined weights for 50 elements. Pretty good. He was right on almost all of them in terms not only of the precision, but also of what the integer was, whether it was mono, di, trivalent, and so on in many cases, but not all. Now, he also worked on elemental analysis, as he had to do in order to find out what the ratios of things were in these compounds. And in particular, organic analysis was done by this, with this apparatus, by combustion. The same way, remember, Lavoisier determined how much carbon, how much hydrogen was in. And remember, Lavoisier had this machine about as big as this table that required three or four people to run it. Here is Berzelius' version of the same thing. Okay, so first he takes a tube and necks it down a little bit to make it thin, and he puts in, it's a half inch diameter, and he puts in a dried powder that has half a gram of the substance to be analyzed, 3 grams of sodium chlorate, remember that's what Gay-Lussac found was good for oxidizing things cleanly, and 50 grams of sodium chloride, which is just to be inert so the thing doesn't explode when you start heating it. Okay, then he heats and bends the neck of it down like that and inserts the neck up at the top there into that bulb, which is attached to a tube. So the bulb condenses water, Okay? And the water that doesn't get condensed there is caught by calcium chloride in the drying tube. So you weigh those two things before and after, and you get how much water came out, therefore how much hydrogen was in the sample that was burned with sodium chlorate. Okay, so then you assemble it down below with the calcium chloride tube having an exit that goes down under this bell jar. Okay, so the bell jar has so the gases O2 and CO2 that come out of here, because if you heat sodium chlorate you can get oxygen out. Okay, so there's going to be both oxygen and CO2 that are going to come down, and they're going to bubble up in here. Okay. Now, whoops, I'm back. I went a little too fast. But there you see they come and they bubble up, right, and fill the area in the top of the bell jar. But floating in the bell jar is that bulb up above, which contains a base that will absorb CO2, but not oxygen, okay, that will react with CO2, a solid. And also, the lid is... There's glove leather tied over there so that the mercury that's in the jar won't get inside, because mercury is going to really change the weight of things if you got a little extra mercury in there. So what he does is he builds a fire here, heats it up. It's wrapped with metal so the tube won't explode, because you're going to have a little pressure in here in order to push the gas into the bell jar under the mercury. So when you heat the glass, it's going to get soft and it'll pop. Okay, but he wraps it with metal so that it won't. So now it starts up. You collect the water here and here. The CO2 and oxygen come in here. The CO2 will go through the leather, and the oxygen will too. But inside here, it will get absorbed by the sodium hydroxide. Right? So you build the fire, heat it slowly from here back to here. The tube is wrapped with metal sheet to keep it from popping. Okay? And then when you're done and it cools off, you wait, and the mercury will rise again as the CO2 gets absorbed by that. And then you take it off, you take off the glove leather, you clean it to make sure there's no mercury on it, and you weigh it, and that's going to be how much CO2. But you had to wait quite a while. To be certain that the potassium hydroxide absorbs all the CO2, you had to wait 12 hours after the mercury stops rising. So the mercury rises as CO2 gets absorbed. But to be sure all of it is absorbed, you have to wait till it stops and then wait another 12 hours to make sure you get all the CO2. Then you disassemble it, weigh it, and you get how much carbon there was in the sample. Yeah.
Didn't you say there was also oxygen in there? Yeah, there's oxygen, but once
you take the lid off, you have air inside. You don't care about the gas. What gets absorbed by the CO2, by the potassium hydroxide, which is CO2, that's what increases the weight of the bulb. When you weighed it in the first place, there was air inside. Afterwards, there's air inside, but there's also CO2 absorbed on the solid. Okay, so you take the lid off, you weigh it, and so on. Now, electricity. So the Royal Institution was an interesting organization, which still exists, was founded by Count Rumford, this guy over here, who married Lavoisier's widow. They ultimately had a falling out in which she poured boiling water on his flowers, his prize flowers. So they didn't last very long. But anyhow, he was quite an adventurer. He was American, actually, though he was a count in Bavaria. And so he established this thing where people in society could come and on Friday evenings hear lectures about the latest thing in science. And one of the fancy things in science was breathing gases like N2O that made people behave funny and so on. So this guy here is Humphrey Davy, and he had come from the West and had done such things in Bristol, had made these demonstrations, so Rumford hired him to come to London to do the same thing. But he did other things too. He became the director of the Royal Institution and established the first really big science in England. Okay, now, Alessandro Volta had just a few years earlier, like within 15 years before, had made this thing called the voltaic pile. Actually, it was only 10 years before, as you see, which generated electricity, as you know. It's a battery. So, Davy started doing this. If you put copper and zinc together, you get 1.1 volts, right? But if you put 24 pairs of copper and zinc to make a battery in a row, then you get 26 volts. And he had a thing like this where each of these metal plates was, I think, 6 inches square or something like that. Or no, 10 inches they were. And then here's the battery that Betzelius used at the same time, the copper and zinc. Okay. But he could put more of them together and get 110 volts. Or he could put even more of them together and get 165 volts. Or he could link these together in series. And then he could get 301 volts. Right? Now, you can imagine doing neat demonstrations with this kind of thing. So here's his report in 1888. He said, I acted upon aqueous solutions of potash and soda. Do you know what potash and soda are? They're potassium and sodium hydroxide. That's not, those are ancient names as you can read in the on the web page, but it's not coincidental that potassium and sodium come from potash and soda. Anyhow, it's saturated solutions. And he used the highest electrical power I could command, which was produced by a combination of voltaic batteries belonging to the Royal Institution containing 24 plates of copper and zinc, 12 inches square, 100 plates, 6 inches square, and 150 plates, 4 inches square. That's what I showed you before. So he hooks them together, and what happened? Though there was a high intensity of action, the water of the solutions alone was affected, so all he got out was hydrogen and oxygen, the same thing Gay-Lussac had done. The hydrogen and oxygen disengaged with the production of much heat and violent effervescence. I mean, you can imagine this if you put what it was, 310 volts or whatever it is across this. Okay. The presence of water appearing thus to prevent any decomposition of the potash or the soda, I used potash in igneous fusion, so he melted potash instead of using water to dissolve it. By means of a stream of oxygen gas from a gasometer, a gasometer is more or less like the thing Lavoisier used to generate air, although Davy just used oxygen, so he got a much higher, hotter flame. So he used that with the flame of an alcohol lamp, which was thrown on a platinum spoon containing potash. So he had this spoon containing potassium hydroxide that was being heated by an oxygen alcohol thing until it melted. Okay, it was kept for some minutes in a strong red heat and in a state of perfect fluidity. The spoon was preserved in communication with the positive side of the battery of a power of 100 of 6 inches, highly charged, and the connection from the negative side was made by a platinum wire. So now he puts whatever it is, 110 volts or something across this melted potash. By this arrangement, some brilliant phenomena were produced. The potash appeared a conductor in a high degree, and as long as the communication was preserved, a most intense light was exhibited at the negative wire, and a column of flame, which seemed to be owing to the development of combustible matter, arose from the point of contact. Can you envision him doing this before the society matrons and so on, with this melted potash and putting the voltage across and flames coming up? A small piece of pure potash had been exposed for a few seconds to the atmosphere so as to give conducting power to the surface. So don't melt it this time, right? But get a little moist so it'll conduct on the surface. Was placed upon an insulating disc of platina, conducted with the negative side of the battery of the power of 250 of 6 and 4 in a state of intense activity, and a platina wire communicating with the positive side was brought in contact with the upper surface of the alkali. Small globules having high metallic luster and being precisely similar in visible characters to quicksilver, which is of course mercury, that's silver that's quick, that's live, that'll flow. Okay? So like quicksilver. So what was he making? Can you see? He was making potassium metal. Okay? they appeared, some of which burnt with explosion and bright flame as soon as they were formed, and others remained and were merely tarnished and finally covered by a white film which formed on their surfaces. Do you have any idea what the white film was? Potassium hydroxide. It reacted with moisture in the air. Okay, so in this way he invented sodium and, or discovered, I don't know which, but I guess he invented the metals, sodium and potassium. They didn't exist before. Okay, but there was a lot of rivalry at this period during the Napoleonic period between Great Britain and France, of course. And when Napoleon heard about this, he was disappointed that the French hadn't been the people who made this invention. So he called his scientists together and said, what do we have to do to beat the English scientifically? And they said, well, we can't do this. They have this enormous battery. He said, no problem. Do what you have to. So Napoleon got Gay-Lussac to build this battery. So this is a battery that has 600 copper plates, each weighing 1 kilogram, and 600 zinc plates, each weighing 3 kilograms. So there are 2.6 tons of metal in this battery. And then you have these barrels with the electrolyte that you put into the batteries. And then, as you see from the wires, you connect the whole bunch of them in series. Right? So now, up here at the top, you got 650 volts or something like that. So they wanted to show this off to Napoleon. He wanted to see it once France had the best battery. So he came to the lab, and here's the report of what happened when he came to the lab and to the 650 volts. With that rapidity which characterized all his motions, and before the attendants could interpose any precaution, he thrust the extreme wires of the battery under his tongue. You know, people had done this, you know, with, have you ever heard it, felt the tickle from a battery, if you put it in your tongue? But that, you didn't use 650 volts, right? And he received a shock which nearly deprived him of sensation. After recovering from its effects, he quitted the laboratory without making any remark and was never afterwards heard to refer to the subject. So there's what happened to Napoleon on this occasion. Okay, but Davy wasn't to be outdone, so he built this battery for 2,200 volts at the Royal Institution. So with these batteries, Davy was able to invent or create all these metals, boron, sodium, magnesium, potassium, calcium, and barium. All of them he made by electrolysis. So electricity supplied more than new elements, though. It also gave theory, the idea that positive and negative things would attract one another. So this is an organizing principle for making compounds. You have positive things and negative things that hold on to one another. And this is called dualism, because they're positive and there's negative. They're two kinds of electricity, or of charge at least. Okay, so we can see an example. Remember we talked before about vitriolum cupri, copper sulfate. So here's some copper sulfate. See if you can... can you see that well there? And it's blue. I don't know if you can see it well from the top or not. Yeah, so it's pretty... It's a nicer blue than that. I think you can see it from where you are, can you? Better like that. Okay, and we take... So that's copper and sulfate holding together, positive and negative. And here is sodium hydroxide. So we'll put a little sodium hydroxide in there, right? And it made a precipitate. And this is one I did earlier. And you can see that the precipitate at the bottom actually is whitish. It's not blue colored the way the previous stuff was, or at least it's much lighter blue. I'll pass these around and you can make sure there's no sodium hydroxide on it, so don't drink them, okay? So there's... Okay? So here was a reaction that happened because of what's called double decomposition. So we mixed copper sulfate with caustic soda, sodium hydroxide, and we got double decomposition. The idea is you have A with B and C with D, and you change partners. That's double decomposition. So you get AD and CB. right? So like sodium hydroxide and copper sulfate that was blue gives this light blue precipitate. Okay, in fact, the reaction is much more complicated than that. There are many different complexes in there. But at any rate, this is explained by electricity, by dualism, that one thing is plus, another is minus, but you can change partners, minus for minus, for example, right, and have a reaction like this. So this is dualism to explain a reaction. Okay? And in fact, I suspect you learned that in high school, right? That's the way such things are often still discussed. Now, the word electronegativity, which people like so much, arose at this time. And the first use of electronegativity, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, was in 1837 in James Dwight Dana's System of Mineralogy, a book which is still in print. Right, it's in like the 8th edition or something like that, but it's still the Bible of mineralogy. And he said in 1837, when chemistry has so far advanced that the relative electronegativity, if I may so call it, or electropositivity of the several elements is fully known, we shall probably be able to construct a natural arrangement of minerals on chemical principles, according to these double decomposition ideas. Now, here's a picture of James Dwight Dana, who lived 1813 to 1895. And this is a picture of his house. Has anyone ever seen that? What? Where? Where? But that particular house, have you ever seen it? Have you ever seen this building back here? This is at the corner of Hill House and Trumbull Street. It's right across from the Health Services Center. You ever go there? It's the home of the Statistics Department now. And in fact, he was Benjamin Silliman's son-in-law, the guy that stands out here and holds the crystal in his hand. And Silliman lived across the street here. Okay? So Dana is the guy who first used the words electronegativity and electropositivity, although ultimately they came to mean other things, as we'll see later on. But the idea was dualism, right? Positive and negative things holding together and changing partners. Okay, so we've seen these guys, and elemental analysis, atoms, and dualism. And now we're going to go on to the next big development, which happened in the 1820s and 30s, to urea, which I think some of you have heard about, but we're going to talk about different aspects of it, about isomers. So urea is experimental, the things in boldface. Isomer is a concept that came from it. Benzoyl is a real thing, but the idea of a benzoyl radical is a theory. And then the idea of substitution and types. So the people who were most associated with this are this pair of people, all born near the same time, within a year or two of one another. Dumas in Paris, Liebig and Wöhler in Germany. Okay, and there, here we see Wöhler and Liebig on the front of our building. Notice that they were born within 3 years of one another. Wöhler just a little bit older than Liebig. And this is Wöhler writing to Petzelius when he was 20 years old. Or no, when he was 23 years old. He was born in 1800. Having developed the greatest respect for you through studying your writings, I have always thought it would be my greatest good fortune to be able to practice this science under the direction of such a man, which has always been my fondest desire. That language in these letters doesn't change much over the centuries. People still get letters that sound very much like this. Okay. Although I earlier had planned to become a physician, people tend not to put that in anymore. Okay. And then he ended with the greatest respect, Friedrich Wöhler from Frankfurt am Main. So he went and worked for a year or two with Petzelius in Stockholm and then came back to Germany to teach. And he wrote a letter to Petzelius in 1837, to see our old friend Palmstedt again, especially here in Göttingen, was a real delight. He was just the same old guy, with the sole exception that he no longer wears the little toupee swept up over his forehead as he used to do. So he liked to make cartoons and jokes and horrible puns, as you'll see later on. He was, I think, a very nice guy. Okay. But in 1828, he wrote to Petzelius, I think Monday, I forget when I said it was for, you see on the, see on the web. Okay. So he wrote this letter to Berzelius. Perhaps you still remember the experiment I carried out in that fortunate time when I was working with you, in which I found that whenever one tries to react cyanic acid with ammonia, a crystalline substance appears which is inert, behaving neither like cyanate nor like ammonia. So when you had double decomposition, you had these two things in there, the positive and the negative thing. You could mix them with something else, and if that something else was something that had recognizable properties, then you knew what was in the original thing because you could make it into something you knew. So that's what he tried to see, whether he tried to mix things to get cyanic acid with ammonia to get ammonium cyanate, but it didn't behave that way. It didn't seem to have cyanate in it. Okay, so this is he tried to do this double decomposition, ammonium chloride and silver cyanate, to get ammonium cyanate and silver chloride, which precipitates, as you know. And then he tried to work then with the ammonium cyanate to prove what it was. Okay, so one thing you can do with ammonium is treat it with base and get ammonia, which you can then smell. Okay, but that didn't happen. There seemed not to be ammonium in there. So it wasn't like an ammonium salt. And you can smell cyanic acid. I wouldn't recommend smelling a lot of cyanic acid, but it had a characteristic odor. But he didn't get that when he treated it with acid. Nor did when he treated it with lead did he get the lead cyanate precipitate. So it seemed that this stuff wasn't, that he got by this double decomposition reaction, was not ammonium cyanate. If it was not ammonium cyanate, what was it? Well, it gave, if treated with nitric acid, it gave brilliant crystal flakes. Right? And he had seen those flakes before. They were just like the ones you get by treating urea with nitric acid. So it looked like what he had formed in making ammonium cyanate was urea. Now, did this make theoretical sense? Well, Berzelius wrote back to Wöhler, "It is a unique situation that the salt nature so entirely disappears when the acid and ammonia combine, one that will certainly be most enlightening for future theory." But the question was, might ammonium cyanate actually be urea somehow? Okay. Wöhler wrote back to Berzelius, "I recently performed a small experiment appropriate to the limited time I have available," he was doing heavy teaching, "which I quickly completed and which, thank God, did not require a single analysis." Remember how troublesome these analyses were, the thing when you have to wait 12 hours for the and put the glove leather on and all that stuff. But he didn't have to do that because urea had already been analyzed. A physician in London, Dr. Prout, in 1817 had actually analyzed urea and got these results for the composition of nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. And Wöhler didn't have to do an analysis of his ammonium cyanate. He could calculate what the weight ratio should be knowing Berzelius's atomic weights. Okay, so he got those. Now, let's learn something about how they did things by looking at these numbers. First, what you notice is that they're very close to one another. They're less than 2% different. So they're identical, and that was his point, right? That what he had made, this ammonium cyanate, was urea, right? But these, let's compare these, the experimental values and the theoretical values, with modern theoretical values for what we know to be the formula of urea. What do you notice in comparing these? Who did the better job? Aviva? Can't hear. Why do you say so? Right. He was right on the button. And what lesson do you then learn from this with respect to lab? Yeah. Don't fiddle with the data. The data, if you do it right, are correct and still have a value 200 years later. But these, you know, Berzelius' atomic weights were good, but they weren't that good. We have better atomic weights now. Okay. So Prout's experiment is better than Berzelius' theory. So the moral is don't dry lab the way Lavoisier did, where he used theory to correct experiment and experiment to correct theory, right? Now, notice that Prout was so honest that his numbers didn't add up to 100%. right? If you report, if you have error, you don't expect it to add up to 100%, maybe. Okay, so because of this, Prout has become, among historians of chemistry, a paragon of accuracy and honesty, right? But let's look more closely at this. Okay, first notice that Wohler's calculation didn't sum up to 100 either, right? Why not? How did he get these numbers? He knew the atomic weights. He knew what the formula of ammonium was. He knew what the formula of cyanate was. So he knew what the numbers of the different atoms were. So how do you go about getting the weight percentages, calculating them, if you know atomic weights and the formula? What do you do? How do you get the theoretical weight ratios if you know how many atoms of each kind and the atomic weights? What do? You multiply the number of atoms by the atomic weight, add them all up, get the total, divide by that number, which is 100%, and then you get the percent of each one. See how you do that? Now, if you've done it that way, what should you get when you add all your numbers together? Should get 100. Why did he get 99.8? Well, we recalculate it the way I tell you about, using Berzelius' numbers, and we get those. So what do you notice? First, compare those two. What did Wohler do? He didn't round off, he truncated. We would make that 20.20 because it ended in an 8, and this one 6.60, right? You'd round off to the nearer number, not just truncate it, not just cut off the last number. Does that explain the discrepancy? No, it's not big enough to explain that you're off by 0.2. Where's the big error? So he truncated instead of rounding up. But he wrote 2.4 instead of 4.2. Okay? But the main thing is he didn't notice. When it didn't add to 100%, he didn't think, wow, that's telling me something. I must have done something wrong. He just wrote, oh, adds 99.80. Looks good to me. Pretty close to 100, right? Okay. Now, how about over here? So this is an example of Prout's honesty and candor. He does the experiment, and he gets 99.875, and he reports 99.875. Let's see, how do you think he got carbon? By how much CO2 you get? You can read exactly how he did it on the web page. I'll make it a little different to make it quick here. Hydrogen? Where do you get hydrogen? By water that you get out of it. Nitrogen, it turns out you can get nitrogen gas, right? So he measured, in fact, he did all these things by volume. So he got nitrogen gas, and in fact, he was really exactly right with nitrogen gas, right? But what he actually reported, oh, incidentally, he added wrong. Okay, but that thing is so good. But what he actually measured was 6.3 cubic inches. That he measured, presumably, to within one part in 60. And if you look at his apparatus, you see that's reasonable. But he was correct to a part in 5,000. So he was just lucky. Right? Wrong. Right? If you go back to... Because he had a theory. His theory was everything is made out of hydrogen, which he called protyle. Ille prote, the first matter, was hydrogen. And everything else was made of hydrogen. Like carbon was 6 hydrogens, oxygen was 8 hydrogens, nitrogen was 14 hydrogens. Again, there's this question of what the integer multiple should be because of valence, right? But anyhow, that's what he thought they were. So then he did his approximate analysis that we, by measuring 6.3 cubic inches and so on, certain amount of CO2 and so on. He did this approximate analysis, figured out what the ratios must have been, and then used his atomic weights to calculate these numbers. So these, are, in fact, aren't experimental numbers directly. So what it actually shows is So he said the numbers were 1, 1, 2, 1, and therefore you get those. Right? So he dry labbed because he made an approximate analysis and then corrected it using his theory. So what you actually see, so much for his reputation, what you actually see was that his theory was better than Betzelius' experiment. Isn't that cute? Right? His theory was really good. Why was his theory so good in the long run, when you look back? Why was his protyle theory that everything was made out of hydrogen so good? Right? Protons and neutrons have the same mass, and everything is made out of protons and neutrons. So it should come out that way, unless you have isotopes like in chlorine. Okay, now, ammonium cyanate is urea, they said. Okay, so how do you do it? We have a sigma star here that's unusually low. Why on ammonium? On the left, why is sigma star so low? Because of the positive charge, right? And you have the unshared pair and the negative charge on cyanate, so you can attack, make, and break. And you get this, and now you can come back and attack with the unshared pair on pi star. Okay, and you get this, and those will come down and attack. You could do that and put a negative charge on oxygen, or you could do that and put a negative charge on nitrogen, or indeed you can do both because those are resonant structures of one another. Okay, and then at the end you take a proton off the ammonium and put it on to the nitrogen like this. Actually, not like that, because it probably happens between two molecules, because this charge can't get to the back of that one to attack it. But at any rate, you then get urea. Do you always get urea? Is it possible? So that's where I say that it's probably intermolecular. And you could go the other way, but if it did, the proton would come off one side and go on the other side, and you'd end up with urea, the more stable compound anyhow, but you don't know that yet. Okay, but can ammonium cyanate exist? It can exist, and in fact, our old friend and cousin Jack Dunnett showed it in 1998, that this is the crystal structure of ammonium cyanate, which was very difficult to make because it transforms so very rapidly into urea. But by using a special neutron source and a powder of this, they were able to do it. And there's the ammonium ion, and you see it's hydrogen bonded to four surrounding oxygen. So it's an interesting structure, but it shows that there is such a thing as ammonium cyanate. Now, what did Wohler conclude from this work? Everybody cites this as saying that biological things come from non-biological things, right? That's not really so fair, because where did the cyanate come from? And it actually came from carbon, which was formerly life and so on. So that's not so clear. But something that was very clear for chemistry and important was the idea of isomerism. He said at the end of this short paper about urea, "I refrain from all the considerations which so naturally suggest themselves from this fact that ammonium cyanate and urea have the same formula, the same atoms, the same ratios. Especially in respect to the composition ratios of organic substances and respect to similar elemental and quantitative compositions among compounds with very different properties, as may be supposed, among others, of fulminic acid and cyanic acid, and of a liquid hydrocarbon and the olefiant gas, and it must be left to further investigations of many similar cases to decide what general laws can be derived therefrom." People are always limited by what they can imagine and what experiments they know can be done. So if all you can do is measure what elements there are and what ratios, you think, if you don't have good imagination, that that's all there is to know. But what this showed was that there can be different compounds with exactly the same atoms and the same ratios. So that was a big leap forward, to see that there was more than just analysis to these things. So fulminic and cyanic acid we'll come back to next lecture. So the name isomer came from Berzelius, from this paper about tartaric acid and racemic acid. Racemus is a bunch of grapes. Tartar is the stuff that's inside wine casks. So this paper from 1830 dealt with this tartar. Here's an example of calcium tartrate on the top of a wine cork. I'll put it here. You can glance at it on the way out if you're interested. Okay. And we actually did a crystal structure using X-ray of one of these crystals to show that indeed, they're beautiful little crystals, that one of them is calcium tartrate. Okay? So what he said, I thought it necessary, but these two things, tartaric acid and racemic acid, had the same atoms and the same ratios, and all their salts were corresponded. So he said, I thought it necessary to choose between the words homosynthetic and isomeric. The former is built from homos equivalent and synthetos put together. The latter, from isomeris, has the same meaning, although it only properly says put together from the same pieces. The latter has the advantage with respect to brevity and euphony, so you can pronounce it more easily. Thus, I have decided to choose it. So that's where the name isomer came from, 2 years after this urea paper that Wöhler had sent to his former teacher, Berzelius. So brevity and euphony. By isomeric substances, I understand those which possess the same chemical composition and the same molecular weight, but different properties. Okay, so the rest of what is discovered in the 19th century will have very heavily to do with isomers, and we'll get on to that next time. Yeah.
According to the initial homework problem set list, these three people didn't take the exam, but then when...
None of them are there,
yeah,
there anymore.
Yeah, when I went to Class 3-2, none of them were. So everyone else...
So there must be 50 then, including David Steinberg, the guy in the red shirt, who took it. Did he take it late? Yeah, okay. So there must have been one more, yeah. I hope, because otherwise we're missing one.
Yeah, well, I went through the list and I checked off everyone.
Okay, good. So it's okay. Okay, good. Well done. Okay, so now we can get together to score it. Okay, I'll turn this off.